This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not. On this program, we try and read and talk about all different types of stories. We try to highlight some of the passages of writing that we think describe characters and actions or emotions vividly. Usually, this is in novel form, but today I have a verse novel, quicker to read, but dense in impact. Zane Fralin is the author, and the book is Song of a Thousand Seas. Welcome, Zana.
Thank you so much for having me.
Apart from author, you have another title, Overly Obsessed Octopus Lady.
I'll take that title. And, of course, no one can see me, but I am covered in quite a few octopus-related things at the moment. So,
before we talk about the book, let's get some fun octopus facts. What's your favourite?
I think my favourite fact would have to be that octopuses have 9 brains. So they have a brain in each arm, as well as a sort of central brain in their mantle. And the central brain is like this overall brain, which controls the other brains, but each of the arm brains can also act independently.
They've also got 3 hearts, and I don't know who did the counting, 3,154 suckers. My favourite fact, though, is that the different sizes, there's over 300 species of octopuses.
That we know of.
Oh.
There are more being discovered.
And they range from 9 metres to 1 centimetre.
Yeah. I've seen photos of the one, I can't remember the name of the 1 centimetre one, but they're beautiful, tiny little things.
And they can regrow their arms like lizards with a tail?
Yes. In fact, if an arm gets bitten off, they can regrow it. But they've also been found to, if an arm has been removed, cut off, bitten off, whatever, and left behind, then they have been known to take their arm back to their den with them.
Their den. What, they're collecting their dens?
Yes.
But what staggered me was their very short lifespan.
Yeah, on average about 2 years. I mean, it changes between the species, but it's about 2 years, which is very short for such amazingly intelligent creatures.
And they die basically after mating or after when the eggs are ready to hatch. So how do they pass on their intelligence?
We don't know. I mean, the amazing thing about octopuses is they've been around for 330 million years, which is, 10 times as long as Homo sapiens. So the way of working and seeing the world and being in the world is very different and very alien to us. But we share so many similarities as well. They're quite remarkable creatures.
Now, of course, this has nothing to do with the verse novel. This is just
fun octopus
facts.
Fun, yeah.
You've based the story on the hijinks, that's the word, of a real octopus called Houdini. Hijinks?
Well, Houdini, I mean, so the character in the book, Houdini, is based on the real Houdini, but the story is fictitious, and the story is actually based more on the escape of Inky, the octopus, from New Zealand Aquarium. But I did get to meet the real life Houdini, and there's no other word to describe it. I mean, Houdini was curious and intelligent and very playful, very keen to explore.
So, back to the verse novel, Song of a Thousand Seas. Who's the narrator of this?
Of course, the narrator had to be Houdini. And in fact, I came up with the idea for this book after I had a dream where I was an octopus. And normally in my dreams, I'm sort of, looking down on my dream self. But in this dream, I was the octopus. I was looking out through octopus eyes at sort of the light coming in, and I was seeing my tentacles. Oh, my arms, sorry. Yeah. And so I knew immediately that it had to be from the point of view of an octopus.
So where is Houdini's world right now?
In an aquarium.
With Spike?
Yes, with Spike, the starfish.
11-armed starfish. Excellent listener. And who are the people in Houdini's world?
So we have Paul, who is Houdini's, the aquarium keeper, I suppose. And then there are also a lot of school kids, visitors who come to the aquarium. But Paul is Houdini's main point of reference.
And Paul, keys jingle jangling, foot stomps thundering. And he gives toys to Houdini to entertain or distract her from escaping.
Exactly. I mean, lots of octopuses are known to escape, and they need, because they're so intelligent, they need a really rich environment. So Paul tries to give her that.
And there's Joe the cleaner?
Joe is the cleaner, yes.
His, and describing Houdini, looks at him, ears full of music, bursting to dance. He's constantly finding her, retrieving her, and putting her back, but not telling Paul about it.
That's right. I feel they're sort of, they're almost secret friends, really, and they understand each other in a way that perhaps Paul and Houdini don't.
Well, let's hear from one of these. And this is called People Aquariums, and it's about the emotive feeling of being caged.
People Aquariums. We wonder then about people aquariums, whether people have to stay and the only way they can breathe is if we let them, and the animals that would eat them must watch them instead, so they learn how to love them for more than just their flavour. Such places would be very popular. If we lived in the sea, we would suggest it.
Yes, yes. It seems, this is another quote, it seems people are a kind of puzzle, known only to themselves. Houdini uses sea metaphors to describe people's actions. Well, let's have a look at Just Like Us.
Just Like Us. People live on the land and forget that they carry the sea deep inside them. Waves and tides that whoosh under their skin. We hear the water, feel the water, smell the water carried within. And the rhythm of that flow lets us know that once those people came from the sea too.
Really made me think, that one. There are facts in the book that the earth is 70% water, just as humans' bodies are made up of 70% water. Perhaps we could explain moods or hormones on our waves and tides.
Absolutely. I really loved getting into, sort of delving into that aspect of it as well as I was researching and sort of trying to find the similarities between us humans and these alien creatures.
One day, Houdini describes Paul's eyes from the book. Cloudy grey, the water inside him is churning wild and stormed. What's making Paul so sad?
I can't actually remember the part of this.
It's his daughter. His daughter's been suspended from school and has to spend the week helping at the aquarium.
That's right. So Paul is, he can be a little bit frustrated, annoyed. He's very busy, but he's got a kind heart as well. And Juno, his daughter, has to spend a week at the aquarium and gets to become friends with Houdini.
There's one repeated verse about school tours and kids. And in the repetition, the last line has been changed. It's octopuses are boring, but I'm going to get Zana to read another school tour.
School tours. And every day they say the same thing, noses pressed to the glass, and they ask, where is she? Knock, knock, knock. Can't you make her come out? Bang, bang, bang. What's the point if you can't see her? Tap, tap, tap. Is there even an octopus in here? Slap, slap, slap. Can we see something else now? But not today. Today, someone asks something different.
And Juno asks, how did Houdini come to you? Can you remember?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. So Houdini, like, in fact, all octopuses that are in aquariums, was wild caught. And I didn't realise that. I sort of imagined that they were bred in captivity, but they are all wild caught.
Caught in a fishing net, very small, and the sea has many dangers. She's safe in here. So how does Houdini react to Juno?
Houdini and Juno immediately hit it off. And when I was writing this, I definitely relied on my experience of meeting the real Houdini. And I was lucky enough to be invited to Sea Life Aquarium in Sydney, where I got to go behind the scenes and meet the real Houdini and her wonderful keeper, Chelsea. And Houdini was just amazing. I mean, it definitely felt like she was just as excited and keen to meet me as I was to meet her. And there was this wonderful moment where we'd sort of been together for most of the morning, and then her head was bobbing just above the water, and I reached out and I rubbed her between the eyes. I sort of hadn't meant to, but it's something I do with my dogs at home. And she'd been this bundle of activity, and in that moment she completely stilled. And it was as though she was listening and we were very connected, and then she reached out and her arm held mine as well. It was quite remarkable.
Oh, I
did too.
When Juno is sad, and this is a quote, small driplets of sea leaked from her eyes and rippled down her face. Happiness for Juno would be to make a connection with her father, and for Houdini, it is hearing the song of a thousand seas with every one of her brains. So how about read once? Can you do that
one? Sure. Once. Once we felt the rain on our skin, the sink of sun and shimmer of moon, the storm thundering our arms and rumbling from deep, deep inside us. Once we danced in the swirl of tides, curling, twirling, unfurling, and once we tasted stars as they fell from the sky. Their dust still shines in the night.
Well, there's a plan to not only make Juno but also Houdini happy. And of course, as with any good story, you can't give away the ending. The illustrations by Aviva Reed, just gorgeous.
They're fantastic. I was actually asked, who I thought might be a good illustrator, which doesn't always happen. And Aviva was the top of my list. I've long been a fan, so I was delighted when she accepted.
Does look good. You've written quite a few books, and they've all had an agenda. What was it for The Way of Dog?
The Way of Dog was an interesting one because I wrote that when I was in the middle of writing a completely different book, and Scruffity, the character in that, sort of, you know, I felt him trot into my head and refuse to leave. So I had to write down his story. And that was all about, I guess, dogs finding their people and people finding their dogs and dog farms and the meaning
puppy
of
farms.
Home.
Mm. Yeah. Be strong, be fierce. Life is more than a concrete floor.
Yeah.
And, of course, you won an Amnesty CILIP, which is a Chartered Institute of Library and Information Professional Award, for The Bone Sparrow. And this is where I'm going to bring in our other authors, because they know about this. Oh, sorry, Elise and Jane.
Wackett and Jane Abbott.
Oh, you're going to meet them later, more formally by David. But you know about The Bone Sparrow.
Yes, I had the privilege of teaching it last year to some Year 8 students, and it was probably my most favourite unit of the year. It's a really moving, important story, and the students really connected well with it.
So, and The Bone Sparrow, what was it about?
The Bone Sparrow is about a child growing up in an immigration detention centre.
But today we've been talking about Zana Fralon's verse novel Song of a Thousand Seas. It has an octopus who knows her world, looking at humans with intelligence and curiosity. Thank you very much, Zana.
Well, education is a way of segueing into my novel because it deals with schools and such like. But when is a work of art an affront to the moral and ethical values of society? Well, in The Canvas Killings by Elise James, we are forced to address that question. And just as there are double standards in art, we have a doubling up of authors, because Elise James doesn't actually exist. She just so happens to be the pseudonym of Elise Wackett and Jane Abbott. So Elise and Jane, welcome to 3CR.
Thank you so much for having us.
Now, what is so inappropriate about the works of the artist James Montagu Ballantyne?
James Montagu Ballantyne, who was a very renowned artist in fiction, obviously, and went quiet for many, many years, and then brought out a couple of series of paintings. But it evolved that he had actually used the remains of 8 murder victims in his paintings, which he confessed to in the early 90s and was sent to prison. And, you know, it was a shocking crime. Australia was scandalised, the art world was scandalised, and then we move on to present day.
The present day, but just like the giant in Jack and the Beanstalk, James Ballantyne ground the bones of his first 5 victims to dust, but in a horror twist more resembling a Grimm's fairy tale, they were smeared onto stone, moulded to board and painted on canvas to create the most infamous works. Now, this is actually not that far-fetched, because you make references to a couple of authors here. Who are they?
A couple of the artists. Well, it has been done in the past, and even currently, not necessarily murder victims, but artists will often use, you know, their own hair, their nail clippings, things, and they'll sort of build them into their artwork.
Gibson? What did he do? This is a real life case.
Yes.
What did Gibson do?
He used a couple of fetuses, embryos, human embryos, created earrings out of them. This was in the UK, back in, again, I think it was the 90s. Mm. And he put them on a mannequin in an art exhibition. And he was absolutely scandalised because nobody noticed that they were fetuses. So he then announced that they were fetuses, and that got him into trouble.
But here we go. We've got a very fine line here between what is art and what is, well, is it a psychiatric condition that these artists have? Why are they doing it? What is the reason and motivation behind this?
I think a lot of artists enjoy shocking their audience. So something like that is perhaps an inside joke for them.
But is the role of art to confront borders and barriers and social mores or not? When's it too much?
Well, I think we could all safely say that murder is probably crossing the line. But I do think, I think artists, it's like anything, I don't think we can generalise. There are artists who just simply want to create something beautiful. But I think, like most human beings, we crave recognition for our work. We want the acclaim. We want the adulation.
Well, here you've got a problem with Ballantyne because he wants acknowledgement and recognition for his art, but he can't admit to murder. But it's actually, the novel's actually not about him. The works of art are his legacy, but he's got another legacy. There's the human element of those that are left behind. There is Ballantyne's son and wife, his wife Rose, and his son Monty. But Monty isn't Monty. What's going on here? And where do we first meet him?
Well, Monty had the misfortune of being named exactly like his father too. So with such a memorable name and legacy to follow, he needed to change his identity because he would be forever associated with his father's work. We meet him on his way home from parent-teacher interviews because he's now a teacher himself, where he stops to buy some milk and interferes in a robbery, which is a good thing and very positive behaviour, except that his face is then plastered all over the media and he has been trying to keep a low profile.
Well, he becomes a sort of meme or a tweet and such like, and his profile is then spread around the world.
Mm, yes.
Which is not what he wants.
No.
Why?
Well, there are several reasons why. It's partly he doesn't want to be associated with his father. But he is also keeping a low profile because he himself is not perhaps the most upright of citizens.
Yes, he has a few secrets he would like to keep hidden.
Well, speaking of secrets, we have another character here, Aidan Voss, who is also teaching at the school in question, Fleetwood College. But Aidan isn't who he is. What's going on here?
Well, Aidan actually isn't even a teacher, but his intentions are a little bit more pure.
Yes. He's probably the most, well, one of the most honourable characters in the book. But his decision to go to Fleetwood College is motivated by the apparent suicide of his sister, who was a teacher at the college. And he's come down from Sydney. He's a risk analyst, quite an illustrious career. But he's left all of that and he's come down to Melbourne because he doesn't believe in the verdict.
Is this typical of teachers that they have double lives? I'm beginning to wonder here.
Oh, we wish.
Oh, well, I mean, we've got a teacher here that teaches and then writes novels. Is that typical of teachers?
I think a lot of teachers have very vivid imaginations and plenty of fodder to work with.
But we've now also got another character who isn't who she is, but for different reasons, Tamsin Fisher.
And this is probably Sam's biggest problem, because Tamsin is a journalist who is trying to find out whether her birth mother was indeed one of Ballantyne's victims, and she's desperately seeking information about that.
Some answers there, but then there's another thing here, because Tamsin was actually raised by Zelda. Who's Zelda and what's her input to this?
Well, Zelda is Tamsin's adoptive mother, and she is a very, very famous journalist, especially during the time of the Ballantyne trials or the Canvas killings. And she made it almost her life's work to follow that case. So she was obsessed with it, and she was an absolute media darling of Australia. So Australia loved Zelda. So she adopted Tamsin when she was a little baby.
But here's an interesting question, because Tamsin's trying to live up to Zelda's expectations. So is our upbringing, are we condemned by our parents in terms of our own psychology?
Oh, well, I think the nature versus nurture does play into it. Would Tamsin have become a journalist had she not been adopted by Zelda? And what were Zelda's motivations for adopting Tamsin?
Mm.
Because, you know, because she was such a well-known and popular journalist herself, she was praised for picking this poor child up, whose mother may or may not have been one of the victims. Certainly she was a missing person. But was she doing it to help Tamsin, or was she doing it to help her own
profile? And, yeah. And she's also a narcissist. Zelda was a narcissist. but she's in an old folks home. She's now got
dementia.
So she can't remember anything. But, yeah, poor Tamsin's trying to live up to those expectations. But really, are they parental or are they innate? Because now we get another question, because we've got Aaron, who is the son of Monty, who's Sam, who's, you know, it's complicated. But Aaron has a hearing difficulty, but so did Ballantyne. Aaron has a natural talent for art, as did Ballantyne. So we get the question of the traits we actually inherit. What can you tell us there?
Well, Sam would like to think that that they possibly weren't inherited, and then there was all just a horrible, horrible coincidence. When Aaron is diagnosed as a baby with a hearing problem, he's beside himself.
Well, I think he's really, really worried he's going to show some of his grandfather's other traits, which is his big concern.
Well, again, it leads into the question of one's inherited psychology. You go into sociopaths, psychopaths and such like.
Mm.
Is this something innate in our DNA, or is it something we learn?
I think that depends on who you ask. And I think that's one thing that Isha said, you know, that there's, you know, really there's possibly not a lot of difference, and that there can be, you know, people could be both. I think the problem for Aaron, getting back to Aaron, is once again, it's the same problem for Tamsin. Would she have become a journalist had it not been for Zelda? Is Aaron ever going to exhibit the same tendencies as his grandfather? Or might he have completely slipped under the radar and just simply become a great artist?
Mm.
But with what happens.
Yeah, I mean, children
in
often.
The end of the novel.
Yeah,
who knows?
Children often acquire talents, and you wonder where it's from. You know, no one in the family can sing like that or paint like that or do.
Mm.
Or is there? We often, but this is our fault, so society's fault, for ascribing talents to families and such, like you must be like your father or things like that.
Yeah.
But Aaron does get into trouble.
He does.
He does, yes.
So is that an indication that he's got a propensity towards being a sociopath?
Well, it could be.
It could. But, of course, you know, he's had a couple of traumas to deal with. And is he simply acting out, which is, you know,
a lot of young people do, but a lot of what adults do as well, because every one of your characters has a double life in terms of inherited trauma.
Well, we're all, I suppose, works in progress and living with what's happened to us in the past. Yeah.
We're all bent and twisted.
Well, and we're all trying to, you know, present our best selves, I guess, and hide the other parts.
It only comes
away.
Out on radio when that happens. But again, we've also now got another dimension here. Who owns these works of art? Because we've now got Sam's father-in-law, Frank. And there's a bit of dealing going on here. Frank's a businessman. And also we've got the gallery owners too. What's going on here?
And how much did they know?
Yeah.
And also, you know, whether they'd reveal it because they stand to profit from it. So it's an interesting moral dilemma for them.
Well, an interesting moral dilemma, because you actually touch on it. Can you sell a work of art that contains human remains?
And what constitutes?
What constitutes
human remains? That's another question we had to delve into.
But I think we answer the question by saying, I mean, morally, would you want to sell art that contains human remains? I think that's a moral question and is up to the individual. But once the crime has been dealt with, like Ballantyne was
convicted,
and handed life sentences. Therefore, what is the crime
in owning
Owning a painting?
But who would want to own a painting, knowing it contains human remains?
Correct.
There's
somebody,
another element.
Somebody quite sick.
Yes.
Well, we would think,
but it's a work of art.
Or again, is it someone who's aiming to shock just by owning it?
Well, or to sort of paint their own picture of status and power and prestige. Because you've got another problem here now as well. Do you destroy has been described as a work of art, even though it contains human remains?
And what about the victims' families? You know, would they want the artwork or... Yeah, it's very problematic.
Well, it's a reminder of the human trauma that's going on in all of these people's lives. All of them seem to be centred around schools. Is there something you've got against schools? Because you've got references to John Donne, "Do not send to know for whom the bells toll, they toll for thee." My favourite was "Once more unto the breach, dear friends." But you make reference to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, 42, the magic number for physics and all of these sorts of things. So there's a wealth of sort of a culture in a school that is a concentrated melting pot in many ways.
It is. And I like the camaraderie of the teachers, because you often, this is probably not the right things, but sometimes you can go into do battle against the students. It's us or them. So you do get this nice united force happening with the students, and the lots of war metaphors as you teach. But it's not normally like that, I must say.
Well, there are schools and there are schools that we have in place. But here's the other thing. You've collaborated on writing this story. How did you do that?
Well, it was particularly difficult for us because I live in Bendigo. And before, when we first started, I was actually in Kyneton, and now I'm in Bendigo, and Elise is down in Melbourne. We did sit together for 2 days, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Opposite at either side of a table.
Brainstorming.
And I lasted for 2 days, and I said, I can't do this. It's not working for me.
It was quite funny. After we'd brainstormed and got started on the story, we both got our laptops out and sat next to one another and said, okay, let's write. And we just froze.
Yeah, it was so alien. So then we parted, and we did it remotely. We email after email,
and phone calls,
3, sometimes 10 phone calls a day. And just sending each other
chapters.
Back and forth, chapters, and I don't know how many drafts we ended up doing.
Yes.
5, 6?
There were a lot of drafts.
And one other quick question, last question. Jet Books.
Yes.
Yes.
You are your own publishing company.
We are our own publishing
what
company.
What prompted that?
I think we, in one way, wanted to be in charge of our destiny, whatever that is, and keep control of our rights and our works, and I don't know, it just
made sense for us, because Elise was working full-time this year, has been working full-time. I escaped to Perth for 6 months, and we just didn't have to... We just didn't want to be approaching publishers.
Yeah.
There are twists and turns in the novel and revelations we cannot talk about. We have a serial killer. We have artists who have conflicting agendas and complex psychologies. And we have the next generation who inherit the reputation and the fear of being like their parents in the
Canvas Killings.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.